This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, October 10th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Three Iraqi policemen, five civilians, and the suicide bomber were killed today in a massive explosion that also killed two U.S. soldiers, a U.S. military police spokesman said. A hospital official said another 38 people were wounded in the blast, which sent bodies flying onto the roof of the police station. One policeman said he found the bearded head of the attacker. It was the deadliest attack in the Iraqi capital since 22 people were killed in a suicide bombing of the UN offices on August 19th. Another U.S. soldier was killed in a rocket-propelled grenade attack in Baquba, northeast of Baghdad, and more than 10,000 Iraqis marched in the streets shouting no to America, according to CNN. Ironically, amidst all this recent violence, Bush has started a media campaign to sell positive images from Iraq, claiming that the media has failed to cover the, quote, good stories in that country. On this special edition of Peace Watch today, our last day on the air, we present a speech by Indian peace activist and political essayist Arundhati Roy. Speaking at Riverside Church in New York City back in May, Roy shared her thoughts about the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the failure of U.S. forces to protect the antiquities at the Baghdad Art Museum, and the civil and political unrest that has enveloped Iraq. She calls her speech Instant Mix Imperial Democracy. Buy one, get one free.
In these times when we have to race to keep abreast of the speed at which our freedoms are being snatched from us, and when few can afford the luxury of retreating from the streets for a while in order to return with an exquisite, fully formed political thesis replete with footnotes and references, what profound gift can I offer you tonight? As we lurch from crisis to crisis, beamed directly into our brains by satellite TV, we have to think on our feet, on the move. We enter histories through the rubble of war, ruined cities, parched fields, shrinking forests, and dying rivers are our archives. Craters left by daisy cutters are libraries. So what can I offer you tonight? Some uncomfortable thoughts about money, war, empire, racism, and democracy. Some worries that flit around my brain like a family of persistent moths that keep me awake at night. Some of you will think it bad manners for a person like me, officially entered in the big book of nations as an Indian citizen, to come here and criticize the US government. But speaking for myself, I'm no flag waver, no patriot, and I'm fully aware that venality, brutality, and hypocrisy are imprinted on the leaden soul of every nation. But when a country ceases to be merely a country and becomes an empire, then the scale of operations changes dramatically. So may I clarify that tonight I speak as a subject of the American Empire. I speak as a slave who presumes to criticize her king. Since lectures must be called something, mine tonight is called Instant Mix Imperial Democracy. Buy one, get one free. Way back in 1988, on the 3rd of July, the USS Vincennes, a missile cruiser stationed in the Persian Gulf, accidentally shot down an Iranian airliner and killed 290 civilian passengers. George Bush I, who was at the time on his presidential campaign, was asked to comment on the incident. He said, quite subtly, "I will never apologize for the United States. I don't care what the facts are." I don't care what the facts are. What a perfect maxim for the new American empire. Perhaps a slight variation on the theme would be more apposite. The facts can be whatever we want them to be. When the United States invaded Iraq, a New York Times CBS News survey estimated that 42% of the American public believed that Saddam Hussein was directly responsible for the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And an ABC News poll said that 55% of Americans believed that Saddam Hussein directly supported Al-Qaeda. None of this opinion is based on evidence, because there isn't any. All of it is based on insinuation, auto-suggestion, and outright lies circulated by the US corporate media, otherwise known as the free press, that hollow pillar on which contemporary American democracy rests. Public support in the US for the war against Iraq was founded on a multi-tiered edifice of falsehood and deceit, coordinated by the US government and faithfully amplified by the corporate media. Apart from the invented links between Iraq and Al-Qaeda, we had the manufactured frenzy about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. George Bush the Lesser went to the extent of saying it would be suicidal for Iraq, for the US not to attack Iraq. We once again witnessed the paranoia that a starved, bombed, besieged country was about to annihilate almighty America. Iraq was only the latest in a succession of countries. Earlier there was Cuba, Nicaragua, Libya, Granada, Panama. But this time, it wasn't just your ordinary brand of friendly neighborhood frenzy. It was frenzy with a purpose. It ushered in an old doctrine in a new bottle, the doctrine of preemptive strike, also known as the United States can do whatever the hell it wants, and that's official. The war against Iraq has been fought and won, and no weapons of mass destruction have been found, not even a little one. Perhaps they'll have to be planted before they're discovered. And then the more troublesome amongst us will need an explanation for why Saddam Hussein didn't use them when his country was being invaded. Of course, there'll be no answers. True believers will make do with those fuzzy TV reports about the discovery of a few barrels of banned chemicals in an old shed. There seems to be no consensus yet about whether they are really chemicals, whether they are actually banned, and whether the vessels they are contained in can technically be called barrels. There were unconfirmed rumors that a teaspoonful of potassium permanganate and an old harmonica were found there too. Meanwhile, in passing, an ancient civilization has been casually decimated by a very recent, casually brutal nation. Then there are those who say, so what if Iraq had no chemical and nuclear weapons? So what if there's no Al-Qaeda connection? So what if Osama bin Laden hates Saddam Hussein as much as he hates the United States? Bush the Lesser has said Saddam Hussein was a homicidal dictator. And so the reasoning goes, Iraq needed a regime change. Never mind that 40 years ago, under the CIA, under President John F. Kennedy, orchestrated a regime change in Baghdad. In 1963, after a successful coup, the Ba'ath Party came to power in Iraq. Using lists provided by the CIA, the new Ba'ath regime systematically eliminated hundreds of doctors, lawyers, teachers, and political figures known to be leftists. An entire intellectual community was slaughtered. The same technique was used to massacre hundreds of thousands of people in Indonesia and East Timor. The young Saddam Hussein was said to have had a hand in supervising the bloodbath. But in 1979, after factional infighting within the Ba'ath Party, Saddam Hussein became the president of Iraq, In April 1980, while he was massacring Shias, the U.S. National Security Advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, declared, "We see no fundamental incompatibility of the interests between the United States and Iraq. Washington and London overtly and covertly supported Saddam Hussein. They financed him, equipped him, armed him, and provided him with dual-use materials to manufacture weapons of mass destruction. They supported his worst excesses financially, materially, and morally. They supported the eight-year war against Iran and the 1988 gassing of Kurdish people in Halabja, crimes which 14 years later were reheated and served up as reasons to justify invading Iraq. After the first Gulf War, the Allies fomented an uprising of Shias in Basra and then looked away while Saddam Hussein crushed the revolt and slaughtered thousands in an act of vengeful reprisal." The point is, if Saddam Hussein was evil enough to merit the most elaborate, openly declared assassination attempt in history, the opening move of Operation Shock and Awe, then surely those who supported him ought at least to be tried for war crimes? Why aren't the faces... Why aren't the faces of US and UK government officials on that infamous pack of cards of wanted men and women? Because when it comes to empire, facts don't matter. Yes, but all that's in the past, we are told. Saddam Hussein is a monster who must be stopped now, and only the US can stop him. It's an effective technique, this use of the urgent morality of the present to obscure the diabolical sins of the past and the malevolent plans for the future. Indonesia, Panama, Nicaragua, Iraq, Afghanistan, the list goes on and on. Right now, there are brutal regimes being groomed for the future. Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Pakistan, the Central Asian republics. U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft recently declared that U.S. freedoms are, and I quote, "not the grant of any government or document, but our endowment from God." Why bother with the United Nations when God himself is on hand? So here we are, the people of the world, confronted with an empire armed with a mandate from heaven, and, as added insurance, the most formidable arsenal of weapons of mass destruction in history. Here we are, confronted with an empire that has conferred upon itself the right to go to war at will, and the right to deliver people from corrupting ideologies, from religious fundamentalists, dictators, sexism, and poverty, by the age-old, tried and tested practice of extermination. Empire is on the move, and democracy is its sly new war cry. Democracy, home delivered to your doorstep by daisy cutters. Death is a small price for people to pay for the privilege of sampling this new product, instant mix imperial democracy. Bring to a boil, add oil, then bomb. But then, perhaps, chinks, Negroes, dinks, gooks, and wogs don't really qualify as real people. Perhaps our deaths don't qualify as real deaths. Our histories don't qualify as history. They never have. Speaking of history, in these past months, while the world watched the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq was broadcast on live television, like Osama bin Laden and the Taliban in Afghanistan, the regime of Saddam Hussein simply disappeared. This was followed by what analysts call a power vacuum. Cities that had been under siege without food, water, and electricity for days, cities that had been bombed relentlessly, people who had been starved and systematically impoverished by the UN-sanctioned regime for more than a decade, were suddenly left with no semblance of urban administration. A A 7,000-year-old civilization slid into anarchy on live TV. Vandals plundered shops, offices, hotels, and hospitals. American and British soldiers stood by and watched. They said they had no orders to act. In effect, they had orders to kill people but not to protect them. Their priorities were clear. The safety and security of Iraqi people was not their business. The security of whatever little remained of Iraq's infrastructure was not their business. But the security and safety of Iraq's oil fields were. Of course they were. The oil fields were secured almost before the invasion began. On CNN and BBC, the scenes of the rampage were played and replayed. TV commentators, army and government spokespersons portrayed it as a liberated people venting their rage at a despotic regime. U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said, and I quote, "It's untidy, freedom's untidy, and free people are free to commit crimes and make mistakes and do bad things." Did anybody know that Donald Rumsfeld was an anarchist? I wonder, did he hold the same view during the riots in Los Angeles following the beating of Rodney King? Would he care to share his thesis about the untidiness of freedom with the 2 million people being held in US prisons right now? The world's freest country has the highest number of prisoners in the world. Would he discuss its merits with young African-American men, 28% of whom will spend some part of their adult lives in jail? Could he explain why he serves under a president who oversaw 152 executions when he was governor of Texas? Before the war on Iraq began, the Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance, the ORHA, sent the Pentagon a list of 16 crucial sites to protect. The National Museum was second on that list. And yet the museum was not just looted, it was desecrated. It was a repository of an ancient cultural heritage. Iraq, as we know it today, was part of the River Valley civilization of Mesopotamia, the civilization that grew along the banks of the Tigris and the Euphrates, produced the world's first writing, first calendar, first library, first city, and yes, the world's first democracy. King Hammurabi of Babylon was the first to codify laws governing the social life of citizens. It was a code in which abandoned women, prostitutes, slaves, and even animals had rights. The Hammurabi Code is acknowledged not just as the birth of legality, but the beginning of an understanding of the concept of social justice. The US government could not have chosen a more inappropriate land in which to stage its illegal war and display its grotesque disregard for justice of any kind. At a Pentagon briefing during the days of looting, Secretary Rumsfeld, Prince of Darkness, turned on his media cohorts who had served him so loyally through the war. And this is what he said. "The images you're seeing on television, you're seeing over and over and over, and it's the same picture of some person walking out of some building with a vase. And you see it 20 times and you say, 'My God, were there that many vases? Is it possible that there were that many vases in the whole country?'" Laughter rippled through the press room. "Would it be all right for the poor of Harlem to loot the Metropolitan Museum? Would it be greeted with similar mirth?" The last building on the ORHA list of 16 sites to be protected was the Ministry of Oil. It was the only one that was given protection. Perhaps the occupying army thought that in Muslim countries, lists are read upside down. Television tells us that Iraq has been liberated and that Afghanistan is well on its way to becoming a paradise for women. Thanks to Bush and Blair, the 21st century's leading feminists. In reality, Iraq's infrastructure has been destroyed, its people brought to the brink of starvation, its food stocks depleted, and its cities devastated by a complete administrative breakdown. Iraq is being ushered in the direction of a civil war between Shias and Sunnis. Meanwhile, Afghanistan has lapsed back into an era of anarchy, and its territory has been carved up into fiefdoms by hostile warlords. Undaunted by all this, on the 2nd of May, Bush the Lesser launched his 2004 campaign, hoping to be finally elected U.S. president. Probably constitutes the shortest flight in history. A military jet landed on an aircraft carrier, the USS Abraham Lincoln, which was so close to the shore that, according to the Associated Press, administration officials acknowledged, quote, positioning the massive ship to provide the best TV angle for Bush's speech with the sea as his background instead of the San Diego coastline. President Bush, who never served his term in the military, emerged from the cockpit in fancy dress, a U.S. military bomber jacket, combat boots, flying goggles, helmet. Waving to his cheering troops, he officially proclaimed victory over Iraq. He was careful to say that it was, quote, just one victory in the war on terror, which still goes on. It was important to avoid making a straightforward victory announcement because under the Geneva Convention, a victorious army is bound by legal obligations of an occupying force, a responsibility that the Bush administration doesn't want to burden itself with. And also closer to the 2004 elections, in order to woo wavering voters, another victory in the war against terror might be necessary. Syria is being fattened for the kill. It was Hermann Göring, that old Nazi, who said, people can always be brought to the bidding of leaders. All you have to do is to tell them they are being attacked and denounce the pacifists for a lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same way in any country. He's right, it's dead easy. That's what the Bush regime banks on. The distinction between election campaigns and war, between democracy and oligarchy, seems to be closing fast. The only caveat in these campaign wars is that US lives must not be lost. It shakes voter confidence. But the problem of US soldiers being killed in combat has been licked more or less. At a media briefing before Operation Shock and Awe was unleashed, General Tommy Franks announced, this campaign will be like no other in history. Maybe he's right. I'm no military historian, but when was the last time a war was fought like this? After using the good offices of UN diplomacy, economic sanctions, and weapons inspections to ensure that Iraq was brought to its knees, its people starved, 500,000 children dead, its infrastructure severely damaged, after making sure that most of its weapons had been destroyed, in an act of cowardice that must surely be unrivaled in history, the coalition of the willing, better known as the coalition of the bullied and bought, sent in an invading army. Operation Iraqi Freedom? I don't think so. It was more like Operation Let's Run a Race, but first, let me break your knees. As soon as the war began, the governments of France, Germany, and Russia, which refused to allow a final resolution legitimizing the war to be passed, in the UN Security Council fell over each other to say how much they wanted the United States to win. President Jacques Chirac offered French airspace to the Anglo-American Air Force. US military bases in Germany were open for business. German Foreign Minister Joschka Fischer publicly hoped for the rapid collapse of the Saddam Hussein regime. Vladimir Putin publicly hoped for the same. These are governments that colluded in the enforced disarming of Iraq before their dastardly rush to take the side of those who attacked it. Apart from hoping to share the spoils, they hoped empire would honor their pre-war oil contracts with Iraq. Only the very naive could expect old imperialists to behave otherwise. Leaving aside the cheap thrills and the lofty moral speeches made in the UN during the run-up to the war, eventually, at the moment of crisis, the unity of Western governments, despite the opposition from the majority of their people, was overwhelming. When the Turkish government temporarily bowed to the views of 90% of its population and turned down the US government's offer of billions of dollars of blood money for the use of Turkish soil, it was accused of lacking democratic principles. According to a Gallup international poll, in no European country was the support for a war carried out unilaterally by America and its allies higher than 11%. But the governments of England, Italy, Spain, Hungary, and other countries of Eastern Europe were praised for disregarding the views of the majority of their people and supporting the illegal invasion. That, presumably, was fully in keeping with democratic principles. What's it called? New democracy, like Britain's New Labour? In stark contrast to the venality displayed by their governments, on the 15th of February, weeks before the invasion, in the most spectacular display of public morality the world has ever seen, more than 10 million people marched against the war on five continents. Many of you, I'm sure, were among them. We were disregarded with utter disdain. When asked to react to the anti-war demonstrations, President Bush said, quote, "It's like deciding, well, I'm going to decide policy based upon a focus group. The role of a leader is to decide policy based upon the security, in this case, the security of the people." Democracy, the modern world's holy cow, is in crisis. And the crisis is a profound one. Every kind of outrage is being committed in the name of democracy. It has become little more than a hollow word, a pretty shell emptied of all content or meaning. It can be whatever you want it to be. Democracy is the free world's whore, willing to dress up, dress down, willing to satisfy a whole range of taste, available to be used and abused at will. Until quite recently, right up to the 1980s, democracy did seem as though it might actually succeed in delivering a degree of real social justice. But modern democracies have been around for long enough for neoliberal capitalists to learn how to subvert them. They have mastered the technique of infiltrating the instruments of democracy, the independent judiciary, the free press, the parliament, and molding them to their purpose. The project of corporate globalization has cracked the code. Free elections, a free press, and an independent judiciary mean little when the free market has reduced them to commodities available on sale to the highest bidder. To fully comprehend the extent to which democracy is under siege, it might be an idea to look at what goes on in some of our contemporary democracies. The world's largest, India, which I have written about at some length and therefore will not speak about tonight. The world's most interesting, South Africa. The world's most powerful, the USA. And most instructive of all, the plans that are being made to usher in the world's newest, Iraq. In South Africa, after 300 years of brutal domination of the black majority by a white minority through colonialism and apartheid, a non-racial, multi-party democracy came to power in 1994. It was a phenomenal achievement. Within 2 years of coming to power, the African National Congress had genuflected with no caveats to the market god. Its massive program of structural adjustment, privatization, and liberalization has only increased the hideous disparities between the rich and the poor. More than 1 million people have lost their jobs. The corporatization of basic services, electricity, water, and housing, has meant that 10 million South Africans, almost a quarter of the population, has been disconnected from water and electricity. 2 million have been evicted from their homes. Meanwhile, a small white minority that has been historically privileged by centuries of brutal exploitation are more secure than ever before. They continue to control the land, the farms, the factories, and the abundant natural resources of that country. For them, the transition from apartheid to neoliberalism barely disturbed the grass. It's apartheid with a clean conscience, and it goes by the name of democracy.